go ahead and call the meeting of the Stanislaus County Employees Retirement Association Board to order. Roll call, please.
Gordon Ford. Maria Deanda.
Here.
Donna Riley.
Here.
Jeff Rogan.
Present.
Mike Lynch.
Here.
Darren Garrett.
Present.
Jim DeMartini. Michael O'Neill.
Here.
Joan Lindenen.
Here.
We have a quorum.
Okay, any announcements? Going once, going twice.
You want me to do it now?
Yeah.
Go ahead.
You want me to?
Mm-hmm.
Wanted to let you know about DMS and White Oak. Just a reminder that White Oak was the direct lender of ours that asked for our consent to bring on DMS offshore. They are folks who specialize in advisory committees for these funds. We were asked by Trustee Grover to ask the other two direct lenders what they had heard about DMS. Neither one of them, frankly, had heard of DMS. And so staff has actually started digging a little more into this. The deadline was a week ago last Friday to get this done. We started digging in a little more and came up with a lot of questions. And so we actually returned the consent back to them with no check. And now they are getting more involved, White Oak is, and they want to work with us and try to get us comfortable with DMS. And so we are just now starting down the path of talking with DMS and figuring out who they are, what they have to offer before we actually will do anything with this. So they have pushed the deadline out at least until the next board meeting if we feel that we need to bring something back to you to give you some information on this and get your input, we will. And if not, if we feel comfortable, we'll still go ahead and sign off on it. And if we don't, we won't. So that's what's going on with that issue.
Okay. And just a little update on the custodian bank RFP. We actually had it all posted on the website by our deadline of 8:15. Bank of New York has already verbally told me they're definitely going to bid it. I'm not the formal intent to propose are not due until the 6th of September. But we do know through our website that 40 unique times it's been downloaded. So I expect those are probably the four. I'm hoping they're the four majors, and I don't have to go contact them after I get the notices. But what I'm also getting are questions already. Everything's being done in writing through email, so we can track everything. And I'm getting some people asking if we're interested in third-party vendors. They want a piece of it. And at this point, this is a whole. We're looking for the custody bank. We're not looking for the pieces at this point because that could get a little crazy. But it's definitely getting hits on the website and being downloaded. It's being advertised in the Pension and Investment Magazine and on their website. So we will see what's happening. So September 6th, we'll know who all's interested.
So we can tell who's hitting on our website?
We can't tell who, but we can say we can see the numbers.
And where they're from.
And we can tell whether or not they're unique. You know, I can't
like
drill down to the actual website, because that would be interesting if we could. But I will, the fact that I'm already getting questions by email and that we can see that this many, I think within 2 days we had 19.
You can reach out to the NSA. They can help you with that.
I expect if we needed it bad enough, we would, but it's
realize,
just interesting.
Realize, too, that other folks can tell when you're on their websites, too, and what you download.
Cookies.
But so we're getting interest, and I expect we'll have plenty of reading materials in the not-too-distant future.
All right. Any further questions on that? Okay, moving on to item 5, consent items. If you've had enough time, I'll
move
entertain.
To approve.
I want to ask a question about C. I'll make a comment about C.
Okay.
Yes.
I talked to Rick about this before we convened, and my suggestion, which he does not disagree with, is that this be incorporated with the SIS report later in meetings, not necessarily today, but in the future.
Do you have any history on why this is always on consent, these peer rankings?
I just
it's
know.
It's what your predecessor did.
That's kind of what I thought.
I think it was informational only.
We can stick it out there. It's a quarterly report, so it's not going to take up a lot of time.
Yeah. I second Donna's motion.
Okay, so we have a motion by Maria and a second by Jeff Grover to approve the consent items with the input and change from Trustee Clendenin. So is there any further comment with respect to the consent calendar? Hearing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, so moved. Moving on now to item six, semi-annual performance report by PIMCO. And just so you know, I think we can be respectful of their time and cover everything in a 15-minute presentation. I think is good. Is that all right with Dodge and Cox as well? Whatever, okay.
Hi, Matt. This is Kathy with Dan Sarah. I'm going to put you on speaker.
It's Matt.
Matt Clark.
Hi, Matt.
Hi, folks. It's good to talk to you this afternoon. Can you all hear me all right?
Hear you just fine.
Great. Well, I apologize for not being able to be there in person. I hope everyone's well. It just happened that today was just one of those days where we were a bit scattered to the four corners of the country. But I'm with you in voice and I guess in spirit. So thank you very much for the time to update the board on performance. And I would like to make sure that we cover everything that's important to you. So maybe before I jump in with kind of prepared agenda, we might start by asking what you would like me to focus on. And just as a check, does everyone have the presentation in front of you?
Yep.
Yes.
Yes. Matt, it's Paul. If you could focus just briefly on performance and then positioning of the portfolio and what your take of the recent events since May 22nd when someone blabbered the word tapering, that would be helpful. And then the challenge is if you can do it in about 15 minutes, that would be most appreciative given our agenda.
Sure, absolutely. Thanks, Paul. I appreciate the guidance. Well, why don't we jump right in? We'll start with performance. If you'll turn with me to page 3, which is titled Performance Review in the presentation. You'll notice that the accountant stepped back in 2010 with an initial investment of $75 million, and since then you all have grown the relationship to over $109 million, and we very much appreciate the trust and confidence that you placed in us. If you drop down to the table at the bottom of the page, the main table goes through June 30th, and we've included an additional column to give you the calendar year-to-date through July. Let me just get what I would consider the bad news up front out of the way first. If you focus on the six-month column, which is about, I'll call it three columns over from the end, you'll see that the account returned a negative 2.7% and the benchmark returned a negative 2.4%. Now, that's about 30 basis points of underperformance for the calendar year-to-date period. And if you go one more column to your right, the three-month period, I think it's just helpful to point out that really all that underperformance was concentrated in the second quarter. You can see in the second quarter ended in June, the account returned negative 2.9% and the benchmark returned negative 2.3%. And Paul, I think you've helped me tee up the discussion there because that was really directly related to what was going on in the markets in May and June. And that was very much a dynamic in terms of the discussion regarding what the Fed would be doing. You know, on the more positive vein, we're happy to contribute to your good returns for the fiscal year on a relative basis. For the fiscal year, under the one-year column, the account outperformed by about 30 basis points, negative 0.4 versus negative 0.7. And, of course, on a since inception basis, you remain comfortably ahead of the index and a nice positive return of 4.6% versus 3.9%. So longer-term performance looks good. Second quarter was a challenge. Why don't I spend just a couple minutes talking about how we were positioned going into it, and then we'll talk a little bit about the outlook and the environment, and then I'll make sure to stay to your 15-minute time target. On page 4, we outline really what we were expecting going into the second quarter. And if I were to distill this into the key point, is that for some time now, we have felt that central bank activity, not only within the United States, but more broadly on a global basis, had caused prices for many security markets to become untethered to their fundamental value. So we entered the second quarter actively reducing risk in the portfolio. Now, we primarily focused on the credit sector of the portfolio. So you still have a very high credit quality portfolio. Your average credit quality is AA-. But all in all, we were still relatively constructive on interest rate exposure because we wanted a little bit of that exposure to be defensive in the event that that disconnect between fundamentals and pricing sort of reasserted itself in the second quarter. When the Fed started talking about tapering back in May, the market immediately jumped to the conclusion that it meant not just tapering but tightening. That resulted in a particularly violent sell-off in the fixed income market. We saw interest rates go up by close to 1% in the May, June, and July time period. And so while reducing credit risk was helpful for us, the fact that we were overweight interest rate exposure in general, and particularly overweight treasury inflation-protected securities as a longer-term hedge against inflation risk, that was a particular headwind for us to get through in the second quarter and really drove the underperformance. Now, looking forward at that very bottom couple blocks, I think the key point that we'd like to leave you with is we think a lot of the interest rate movement the market has priced in is overdone. We think the market had basically jumped to the conclusion that the Fed would start tightening, increasing short-term rates. That clearly wasn't the communication intent for Ben Bernanke, and when he sort of realized what had happened, they were very deliberate in walking that back. So we think yields have gone farther than what's merited by the fundamentals of the economy. And we've seen a little bit of that come back over the last day or so. We expect that by the end of the year, you know, rates are going to be moving within a range between 2.5% to 3%. And if you hold our feet to the fire, we say it on December 31st, it's more likely to be closer to the 2.5% than it is to 3%. And that's why we remain constructive on interest rates. And that view is very much predicated on the view that the Fed will be on hold well past 2014 into 2015, and really won't be hiking short-term interest rates until 2016, given the still fragilities that we're seeing in the U.S. economy. You know, to sum all of that up, if you look at page 5, I won't go through all the data on page 5, but I would put to the sell-off in the TIPS market, which we had put into the portfolio as a hedge against nominal interest rate exposure. That was particularly significant in the second quarter, and it was not just the sort of the market changing its view of fundamentals, but it was also very much driven by what we would call technical flows out of ETFs and out of other investor portfolios, most notably risk parity portfolios, that caused TIPS to go up in yield, fall in price. And your portfolio had about a 4% allocation to TIPS. And so that was one of the reasons that we did underperform for the quarter. So that is the performance update. I can shift very quickly in light of your time requirements to how we're thinking about the world, if you would like. But let me pause because I've given you an awful lot of data to digest.
Any questions?
Looks like the floor is still yours, Matt.
Okay, sounds good. I'm not putting you all to sleep. If on page 8, if you'll turn to me, I think this is a great way to really concisely describe our views on the markets. We felt in the second quarter the markets had moved ahead of themselves in terms of moving interest rates higher. The reason we believe that is because we feel that the Fed will be on hold in terms of increasing short-term rates until 2016. And the reason we feel that way is it's on page 8, which is titled Quantitative Easing May Recede, with Fed likely to keep policy rate low. what this page does, I think, a very nice job of pointing out that the Fed really has two different targets that it's worried about, both unemployment and inflation. And on both targets, the Fed is well above where they would like to be. So, you know, it wasn't so long ago that we would have said a 6.5% unemployment rate was relatively high. That's the Fed's target, and we're roughly a percentage point north of that. And on the inflation point, we're almost a percent below where the Fed would ideally like to see inflation, close to 2%. So in light of the fact that we think the Fed will continue to see a shortfall in achieving both policy goals, we strongly believe that the Fed will be reluctant to raise short-term interest rates. And because the short-term interest rate environment will remain anchored at, call it, 0 to 0.25 for an extended period of time, that is somewhat, in our view, a force of gravity for longer maturity interest rates. So the 10-year and the 30-year can move around. We think that they're approaching right now the upper levels of where we would expect them to go. Our next forecasting session is on the 9th of September. And, you know, in all candor, we're going to be arguing about this point, I think, quite intensely, because there are areas of the economy that are quite strong. There are aspects of the economy that exhibit enough demand, housing, autos, things like that. Those could be positive catalysts to cause the Fed to change its evaluations. So we have to be mindful that none of this is written in stone, that it's something that we are following very closely, very attentively. And our conclusion, our positioning right now is very similar to what it was going into the second quarter. One, a conservative portfolio that's relatively constructive on interest rates, emphasizing intermediate interest rates, call it the 5 to 10 year maturities, underweighting longer term nominal interest rate exposure, and selectively substituting that longer term nominal interest rate exposure with Treasury inflation protected securities as a hedge against the potential for a much longer term basis for inflation to higher. That is how we're looking at the world currently, and I think we're going to have the opportunity to visit with you later in September, and so certainly if our views evolve in any way, I'll make sure that the board is well aware of that. You'll be able to get that information relatively quickly after our next economic forecasting session. I'm going to pause there. Again, I do want to be mindful of your time, and I apologize for any of the background noise. I tried to find the quietest spot that I could, but there's a little bit of back and forth in the environment here.
No questions. Paul, do you have anything else?
No.
Okay. Well, thank you, Matt.
Well, if I could just conclude by thanking all of you. Again, we very much appreciate the trust and confidence that you've placed in us. Congratulations on a great fiscal year. I was impressed with the results that you all posted and hope to continue to help you get to your return targets. If you need anything at all, please don't hesitate to let me know. And Paul's certainly good about holding our feet to the fire and helping us to update you. So, again, thank you for your time.
Thank you, Matt.
Thanks, Matt.
Okay. Have a great day.
You too.
Thank you.
Okay, I have a question. Who wants to define Abenomics for me? Use it on page 6.
Abenomics is named after the
market question and effectiveness of Abenomics.
I think Paul's trying to define it for you.
Yes. Abe is the name of the premier of Japan. Nate can tell you his last name.
Shinsu.
Thank you.
Sorry, all right?
So it's unique.
So Abenomics is a catchphrase that was coined after he was elected last fall. He brought his ruling party back to Japan that had been ruling Japan for decades but was voted out a couple years ago, and the party came back in. And his economic policy was one much like the U.S., where he would flood the market with liquidity and easing, and that helped to inflate asset prices in Japan, where Japan, I believe, was the highest returning equity market for the first 6 months of the year. and hence the term Abe Economics.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Okay, does anybody else have any questions in regards to item six?
Mm-hmm. So it didn't get reelected.
Okay, item seven, semiannual performance report by Dodge and Cox. 100 million years, 200 million years. These two guys run this.
But they manage 265.
Commas. Yeah. Great. Well, it's a pleasure to be back here with you. Does everybody have a copy of the book that we mailed in advance, either electronic or hard copy? I have a couple extras. I think I know most of you. I'm Wendell Burkhofer, and this is
Mr. Thompson.
We're your two portfolio managers on the equity and the fixed income portfolios that we manage for Stansera. We're happy to be able to report on some very strong relative performance for both portfolios this year so far and over the past year. A weak absolute return on the fixed income side, and I'm sure Bob will go into that, and a very strong absolute return on the equity side. So there's a lot of interesting things happening in the markets. I'm just going to give you a very quick update on Dodge and Cox. You know us extremely well, so we'll make this very, very quick. And by the way, how much time do you want us to 15 take?
Minutes. 15 minutes.
About 15.
15? Okay. Yeah. We're really going to go fast then. So skip over slide two. You know us quite well. Slide three shows you our assets under management as of June 30th, just over $200 billion. Slide four, our team. And really the only point in including this slide was we wanted to just confirm to you, as we talked about at the last meeting, that there are some management changes that are now official at Dodge & Cox. As of May, Charles Pohl became our chairman, remains our chief investment officer. Dana Emery, who heads up our fixed income area, became our chief executive officer and president. And going forward, they will be leading the firm for at least probably the next decade. They've worked together for about 30 years at Dodge & Cox, so they certainly know each other quite well. And those we've telegraphed those to you, those advancements, for more than a year now. So. With that, I'm going to hand it over to Bob to cover the fixed income area.
I'll do fixed income pretty quickly. Just so you know, Ken, those of you who didn't know, Ken Olivier is now the chairman emeritus. He grew up in Modesto.
I wonder if he did so well.
Exactly. I suspect he's going to be here with his fishing pole a little more often, so running through. Assets under management, I'm going to be very quick. Assets under management. $400 million. We met in the last couple of months. I can't remember when we met Rick, but had a very nice discussion with Rick and the staff about cash flows, etc. Very well. Our performance numbers are on page 7. As Wendell said, they are certainly for the year to date and everything in, they are positive relative and negative absolute. So that's one of those things like don't crow too much. But you can see that certainly it's been decidedly positive on that basis. And from 1 year back, you do have positive returns, all decidedly significantly better than that of the benchmark over all periods. And I would say we've added reasonable value over those periods of time that you're looking for. Wendell and I also put in the one-month returns just to keep you up to speed about what happened. And some of these volatile months, it's been significant, has not been terribly different this last month. We had, you can see this is page 8, slight outperformance again for the 1 month period of time. I want to go, just page 9 is a very quick overview. Where are rates? Where are they gone? They're pictorial here. And a couple things, I always like to show this to you because that number at the top, that's where we were in 2007. People forget that you were in a 5% interest rate environment across the board overnight all the way along. These are treasury rates. And this is 6 years ago, and people were expecting a overheated economy and inflation. So our capacity to see the future is, as we think at Dodge & Cox, very limited and humbling when you look back historically. You can see that the little light blue line, that is the the depths of the recession at the end of 2008. There was a point in time where they moved up, kind of like what you see them here, and then they dropped down pretty dramatically in 2011 when people were so concerned about what happened in Europe. And then you can see most of the movement, especially from that 10 years on and that dotted line, occurred, as the gentleman from PIMCO mentioned, mostly in May and June. And the whole talk was about the tapering of the, in other words, right now QE, which is quantitative easing, has the Fed buying $85 billion of securities every month. Now, they just said, well, we weren't going to do so much about that in the future. They didn't stop buying securities. They just said it. So the only thing that really changed was perception, expectations, the market's reaction to it. And that was that driver of interest rates that went higher. And do they stay higher and continue to move higher? We don't know. Okay. They're certainly higher than they've been. Could they move lower? Yes, they could. Certainly you saw that in 2011 when people had the same perception that you're going to move to higher rates. And when the euro crisis erupted, at the same time, by the way, that S&P lowered the rating of treasuries, same thing, same time. So what happens? Rates just plunged. Treasuries are still considered the world's safety net. And so it's hard to say where they're going to go. But anyway, it is where it is. Market conditions are far beyond treasuries, obviously. Just on page 10, very quickly, the two ones I want to mention there is you have top right, which shows you financial institutions. This is the spread or difference between treasuries. The wider it is, the more uncertain it is. Treasuries versus industrials financials versus industrials were quite wide. We thought in the long run they represent opportunity. You can see they've pretty much mushed on top of each other again. The market seems to be giving credit to the financial markets now that they pretty well cured themselves and are far safer than they were back in the depths of concerned areas. And the bottom left is corporate. These are different ratings over treasuries. The wider, again, the bigger uncertainty. And you can see that if you remove that one crisis area, they still remain relatively attractive, and you'll see that's where pretty much we have kept most of our exposure. On page 11 is just a bunch of quick bullet points. You can read them, but the story is on the top part on what's happened in the market on the year to date. That's what we're covering here. Treasuries went up in yield. Corporate bonds did not perform as well as treasuries, but they were also impacted by those higher rates. And agency MBS, which is mortgage-backed securities, it's the same thing that you have in your portfolio, not quite as well as treasuries. Okay, so your portfolio, what happened? The relative numbers were good, although on an absolute basis, negative, as I mentioned. So what helped? Shorter relative duration, that's your major driver. That when rates go up, if you don't have as much exposure to interest rate changes, you're not going to suffer as much. Now, at the same time, if it drops a lot, you're not going to benefit as much. But you were shorter, that helped. Nominal yield advantage. We have built in a higher yield than that of the market. As time goes by, that comes back and helps you. In the corporate arena, the financial securities did much better and continue to do better. So that we had significant exposure there, so that even though that part of the market didn't do quite as well, what we were invested in did. The kinds of mortgages that we have, they tend to have very little duration. I'll talk about that in a minute. Not as much exposure to interest rate changes. That assisted you. Corporate bonds overall probably did not assist, but as I said, the mix was very good. Okay, and then page 12. We don't change the portfolio very much. We have a very long-term view. We don't do forecasting per se. It's trying to kind of understand where the spectrum of outcomes might be over the next 3 to 5 years. Which I'm realizing in the investment world is like an eternity, but it's where we try to keep ourselves focused. So you can see we have an overexposure to mortgages and corporates. That's where we think that we're being paid reasonably. And you'll see we have very little treasuries, and in fact, it's even less than that. I'll show you that in a minute. Credit quality, we're somewhat barbelled insofar as we have a lot of high quality and then some down at the lower ranges of investment grade and then a couple of less than investment grade. That's where we spent a lot of our time trying to understand those well. Now, at the very bottom, there's a couple of lines that are very important. Yield to worst, that's the nominal yield advantage we talk about. That's about 0.5% higher than that of the market. So over time, that's going to benefit you a little bit by a little bit. And then the bottom line there is the effective duration. That gives you our idea about where our concerns are going forward. And it's about 73% or something like that. That's about as low as I've ever reported to you. So our concerns are that rates are going to go higher. But if they don't and they stay in the same range or even decline a bit, that yield to worst number will continue to assist us.
Can I ask a quick question?
Yes.
You have everything that's less than a BA rating just lumped together.
It's less than or equal to BA. Right, so that's less than, these are below investment grade.
Right. Yes.
Would you like to see the names? Okay.
What I was going to ask is, I can't exactly tell, that's what, 10% of the
portfolio? Yeah, we're allowed to have 15. Okay, that's our limitation. The names are in the back. They're on page 34. Okay. I think you will notice most of the names back there. Okay. But we're allowed to hold up to 15% of that. Okay.
Thank you.
And you're welcome. The page 13 tells you a little bit about how we change relative over the last 3 years. I think that gives you a good idea. We have a very low turnover, they would say. But and then what I want to leave you with is on page 14, which is where are you exposed to interest rate changes in the marketplace. And what we do is we take each sector and we say within that sector, where are your, which ones are really exposed to these interest rates? They have very short duration. There's not much exposure there. So here, take a look at your treasuries. You notice that we have about 10% treasuries. But if you look at what we do, is those two different lines down there. That's the way to look at this. Weight and duration, those are the two different things. So you'll see the market weight, we're quite low. It's only about 10%. But if you look at the duration, we're wildly low. We don't want exposure to that sector. We think it is very low yielding and that we're not comfortable being in it. So you can see you have almost no exposure to direct treasury movements. The other ones to note for you are mortgages. I mentioned earlier we have a very distinct portfolio. It's called higher coupons there. It gives you a shorter duration. As you can see there, it's less than half of the duration of that of the marketplace. And that duration for the market extended significantly during the quarter. Ours did not. That's technically how they have lower coupons, we have higher coupons, but that's what we're trying to do. We're trying to keep it stable, and it worked. And then
on that point, with the large spike up in interest rates since May, especially on a percentage basis, going from 1.7 to 2.7%, it's much different than going from 8 to 9%. The magnitude of your underweight and duration, have you given thought to reduce that as you've been right with the huge spike up in rates?
Yes. You'll see that. You'll see it march out a little bit. Not dramatically, but we're going to take a little bit of that off. We certainly did it in our mutual fund where we have the ability to use futures. We removed some of that futures position. We use a negative number, so we short the future type thing. So we've removed it a little bit, but we're cautious. I mean, we're going to move it. You'll see it. And the other thing is you have to watch what's going on in the marketplace, because that number 5.5, we've only moved about a third or a quarter that of our duration just doesn't extend that much. So it has to be proactively thinking, okay, we're going to go now extend, because we're not going to extend like the marketplace.
Do you expect a further spike in interest rates, or do you think we're range bound?
No. We don't have a specific, but I think at Dodge & Cox, we think we're in a range. We don't see anything. It's much like they said, the Fed has said we're going to anchor at 0% for overnight rates. They've said that as much, and they're going to keep it there for through 2015. Well, you know, I don't see inflation. There's nothing out there that really frightens you. The higher rates.
What about the political situation with Syria?
In where?
with Syria, with the possibility of bombing and war?
You can't, you know, that's a, it's a great question. I mean, that's what they're concerned about today in the stock markets, et cetera. But what is the reaction going to be? I mean, you don't know. If all of a sudden there's war breaks out and the rest of the world says, oh my God, I want safety, and they all run to treasuries, it could lower the rate on treasuries. It's at the same time, maybe people abandon treasuries and they go somewhere else. It's one of those great uncertainties. There's some kind of range. The Fed's not going to change based on what's going on in Syria. You know that's going to be anchored. You know that they're still buying $85 billion a month. So lots of that is, you know, everybody's concerned. We're going to watch. But there's no definitive direction that would necessarily move.
My concern was more with volatility. Would it spike up, down?
You could. Usually those give us opportunities. It's much like what happened in 2008 and again in 2011. If something happens and it drives spreads relatively widely or it narrows them dramatically, we will take some action, either buying or selling those sectors. But we usually wait and try and think about what's going on.
And clearly there is more volatility today because of either Syria or Paul and I were talking about this before the meeting started. You know, maybe people are just using Syria as an excuse to say, you know what, markets had a big move in the last year and year to date. I'm going to take a pause. So there were banks today in the U.S. that have absolutely no exposure outside the U.S. that were down 3 to 4%. So I don't think it has anything to do with Syria. That was just volatility.
Perfect transition. Go ahead.
I know we're running out of time, so any last questions on fixed income?
This is really good. Usually, you know, fixed income goes last and there's no time.
I told Bob he gets to go first today.
So don't, you know, don't dawdle.
Okay, I will try to move quick, 5 minutes?
Sure.
Okay, slide 16 is a summary of your guidelines. Our legal department has asked us to present this to you once a year now. I'm not going to go through it now, but if there's any documents that you've updated that we don't have, just make sure that we get those. I don't think there would be, but we're in compliance with all your guidelines. Slide 17 shows you the value of your equity account as of June 30th, just slightly over $160 million. And you can see with cash less than 1%, we were pretty much fully invested. Slide 18 gives you the performance through June 30th, and then I've updated that through July 31 on the next slide. You can see that year-to-date, up 17% net of fees, very strong absolute return, and 29.7 net of fees for the trailing 1 year, very strong over the trailing 1 year as well. What we maybe care more about, well, we care about both, but is that we've significantly outperformed your index, the Russell 1000 Value Index. We also show the S&P 500, which is a broader market index, but we've outperformed both of those over those time periods by a pretty good margin, which has been enough to, especially with the last year, been enough to pull up our 3-year and our 5-year numbers. Very happy to be able to say that with combined with strong performance last year in 2012 as well, that we've, I think, finally sort of put 2008, early 2009 in the rearview mirror. It's going to be in our numbers forever. But even with those numbers in our performance, we're ahead of your benchmark now on the 5-year period, which of course still includes the worst of the crisis, which was the second half of 2008 and the first quarter of 2009. Those numbers will roll off between now and the end of the year. So you'll see your absolute returns and your relative returns get a lot better between now and the end of the year. You know, barring some pretty crazy events that always could happen. The long-term returns, I think, are probably what we're most proud of, and your 45-year relationship with us, going back to 1968. It goes back so far that we actually don't even have the performance from 1968 to 1972. That we feel we can rely on reporting to you. But we can report 40 and a half years, so that's hopefully that's good enough. The next slide shows you the results through July 31. It was a very strong month for the equity market, up over 5.5% in your portfolio, and ahead of the index for the month. Slide 20 gives you some key factors that helped and did not help for the year to date. I have the 1 year in the back of the book. But very briefly, being overweighted technology really helped you in the first half of the year in relation to the value index. It was the strongest area of the market within your index. But one thing that's kind of interesting is that the value index tech stocks were up 26%. In the S&P 500, the technology sector, which is a broader sector that includes all of the large cap names, was only up 6%. So what was the difference? Lower valuation technology stocks did extremely well in the first half of the year, and some higher valuation stocks, especially Apple, did very poorly, and we did not own those. So that helped you quite a bit. That was by far the biggest plus, and HP was the strongest performer within those tech names.
So why do you think that is? And some of us would like to know, I think.
For HP? For HP specifically?
Yes.
I think we've talked about it here before, I know, many, many times, because I was here. And I think really what has happened is people have finally acknowledged that HP just got way too cheap. I mean, last fall at less than $12 a share, it's about $23 a share today, it was trading at less than 4 times the estimate of this year's earnings, and it has now rallied and is trading at 7.5 times the estimate of this year's earnings. So that's half the market multiple today after it's rallied that much. It isn't that the company has really solved all their issues. They still face some challenges, and their most recent quarter was somewhat disappointing. The stock dropped about 10% in 1 day. But it's still been our biggest contributor this year, even after that drop with the recent quarter. And I think people are giving Meg Whitman some credit now that she's managing the company pretty well for cash flow, and that the free cash flow estimates that the company is expected to achieve in their year that ends about 2 months from now have not gone down this year. They've actually gone up. So I think that's really what's happening, but they do still face issues. That's for sure. The PC market is shrinking.
What is your estimate of the future? Are you going to stay with them, or is it time to get out?
We're staying with it. We talked about it this morning in our policy meeting, which I was not at because I was on my way out here. So I know there's been some recent discussion as of this morning. I don't know. I didn't see any decision that we made, but we still think it is very cheap at one half of the market multiple. It's not going to be the growth company that it maybe used to be. And Ms. Whitman is also shaking things up in terms of management. With the most recent quarter, they replaced a couple of their top 5 managers in the company. So she's not tolerating any mediocre results at all. So we believe there's still good returns ahead, even from this price.
And are you going to stay with Penny?
We actually sold Penny in April, so we've been out of the stock for over 4 months now. It was not a successful investment. I know we talked about it at the last meeting. You can see on slide 22, just to try to wrap up, the individual names that have helped and hurt you. Penny was the largest detractor, but it had a very, very small impact because it was a very small holding. And with the change in management there, we decided we did not want to stick around. They still have challenges. The whole new management team was bringing in a strategy. We had no idea what the former CEO, who they brought back, was going to pursue. And so we've been out for about 4 months now.
And would you expect the same performance out of Microsoft, given the change in management there?
That's a really good question. It's been a strong performer for us even before the change in management was announced. There were a lot of people that felt that this was long overdue, that Mr. Ballmer was not contributing positively to the company. He announced a big reorganization of the company a couple months ago, so it was somewhat surprising that he announced he was stepping down just after that happened, because that really seemed to assert his power at the company. We don't know who the new CEO is, and nobody does yet, because it hasn't been announced they're going to do a search. But we do think Microsoft is very inexpensive, and we're not trimming it back yet.
It was an interesting list on Saturday's Journal of the things he killed over the years.
Yeah, there were some pretty big misses at the company, mobile being the biggest one by far.
I don't know. The online docs, I thought that was a big mix. Because Google Docs is wonderful. And Microsoft could have owned that.
So I know we're out of time. Do you want me to talk about where we're positioned in the portfolio just for 1 minute and then wrap up, or should I stop?
1 minute? Sure.
Okay. So 24 shows you where we're positioned today, as of June 30th, and 25 gives you more detail with the names. Financials is the largest sector in your portfolio, just a little over 20%. Technology is also just a little over 20%. The key difference there is that we're underweighted in financials relative to your index, and we're really overweighted in technology. So that is worth pointing out. Some of the other sectors, I don't think we have time to really talk about. Valuations still look reasonable to us for equities, even though we're getting a correction today. You can see the market is about 14 times the estimates of earnings for the next 12 months. That is not a high multiple, not even close to the kind of bubble valuations that we saw in the late 90s when the equity market was 30 times earnings. But the key is, can earnings continue to grow? And on that note, the economy is doing okay. It's not as good as any of us would like it to be in terms of the growth, but there's about 200,000 new jobs being created every month. Housing has definitely bottomed, and there are many markets now where it's well off the bottom. Auto sales are booming. So there are pockets of weakness still, but we do think earnings can continue to grow from here. So I promised 1 minute, and I better stop.
All right.
I don't know if we have time for any questions, but...
Oh, we always open it up to
thank
questions.
You for your...
Does anybody have any questions? Paul, no more? All done? All in? Okay. Well, thank you both very much.
Thank you.
Coming to the smoke-filled valley and giving us your thoughts of the future.
Thank you for your long-term relationship, and we very much appreciate your trust and value our relationship with you.
Well, thank you both very much.
Hopefully they can get those fires under control. I guess they're making a little bit of progress, but
it's about a little over 20% containment at this point. San Francisco is worried because I guess they are seeing contamination over there at the Hetch Hetch. So, all right.
Well, thank you again.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Paul, you're up.
Yes.
Item 8. So we'll go with Stansara's quarterly manager review list. Did you want to briefly do maybe 5C?
I'll do 5C and I'll.
First.
Manager review list, as I think you can tell from the past 12 months on the monthly performance and the quarterly reports and the rankings that Rick presented at the top of this meeting, all of our managers have done extremely well this past 1 year. And the one manager we had on watch was Dodge & Cox Equity, and you just heard their 1 year number, which has turned things around dramatically from a performance and a ranking standpoint. So our one change would be to move Dodge & Cox Equity from under review to good status, would be our recommendation.
So do we need a motion on that? I don't think we do.
I believe so.
Okay.
Doesn't it show that here? It doesn't. It just shows good standing on this.
Yeah, it doesn't show that.
Okay, we moved it to good standing. There should be a recommendation to move from under review to good standing.
And that's based on the bylaws, and
that's based on 3 and 5 year numbers now being above benchmark and their rankings improving dramatically.
So
from when we put them on watch.
No.
So I don't think we can vote on it.
Nope.
Manager. your review list?
Huh?
I don't think we, I agree with Fred. I don't think we can vote on it.
Can't do that?
It's not an action item today.
Okay. We will make that next time. It can wait.
Yes, you have to notice it.
Right.
Then you're going to vote on it.
So when you gave us this, Paul, you just automatically took them off on this, assuming that we were going to do this?
Yes.
Okay.
My bad. We can take care of it next time.
All right.
Okay.
So this is just a accept and file with no direction.
Okay.
Quarterly performance report. We're going to quickly go through this. This second quarter of 2013, which is the fiscal year ending quarter, page one gives the capital market review. And the major word is the first item, bullet point of tapering. The speech of tapering by Bren Bernanke on May 22nd led to a one-month decline of all assets. There was nowhere to hide during that period except for cash. And it was a pretty dramatic sell-off, although when we look at things after the fact, it didn't seem that bad. U.S. Treasuries, 10 years, were down about 4.5% during that period as yield spiked. It really affected emerging markets, both equities and debt. Emerging markets equities were down in excess of 10% during that one-month period. And EM debt was down a good 8% during that period. U.S. equities were down about 4.5%. Non-U.S. developed were down in the 7% range. Subsequent to that, and the backtracking made, U.S. equities actually did rise to new highs after that correction, with the Dow hitting 15,500 area, although they've corrected back again these last couple of weeks with about a 5% correction from the highs to where they are today on the Dow. Page two, the fund return positive 0.3%, which was 60 basis points ahead of the policy index and ranked in the 38th percentile. Longer term, the 3 and 5 year returns of 12.3 and 6.5% are above median. And what helped during the quarter on pages two and the first part of page three, we have the four passive indices, which really didn't help, but really didn't hurt either. Dodge and Cox Equity 0.4 up 170 bips for the quarter, Legato up 160, LSV up 50, the other international equity manager Pyramus up 200 for the quarter, and Dodge and Cox Fixed Income up 50. What hurt is listed on page three.
On item five there, there's been a lot of reports about back to school shopping being way off. Is that part of consumer discretionary?
Would be consumer discretionary, yes. Although.
So would you expect to see in the next quarter some change there?
The markets have sold off since the quarter ended, but I think what often is thought happening has already been priced in the market ahead of time.
Factor it in.
Yes, and I'm not sure. I'm a small sample size, but I was at Staples last night with my son, and I certainly contributed to that. And it was crowded. But yes, Joan, I mean, if sales come in way below expectations, that's well below what's factored in the market, we could see a decrease in share price in those type of names, the Staples, Office Depots type names of the market. But it's a very small part of the overall market, too. Okay. Although consumer spending accounts for 70% of GDP, so that's certainly a factor.
And I think you're right. Back-to-school spending's not over yet.
Right.
What was that, Mike?
Back-to-school spending's not over yet.
Yeah, not until after Labor Day.
And then what hurt factors, Delaware had a poor quarter after many good quarters, down 180 bips. Capital Prospects the same, down 120. And PIMCO, as they stated, just performing a struggle in this tapering period, down 50 bips. Page four, the fund at the end of June 30th stood at $1.546 billion. The breakdown of managers are on page five. Direct lending was added at the end of the quarter with two of the three hired managers, Calling Capital, Medley, and Raven. Page six, the performance summary. This is a very good report. As Matt from PIMCO said, our fiscal year ending June 30th was very strong with a 14.5% return, 300 basis points above policy, 11.5. That is almost outside the range of expected outcomes, but better to be outside it on the upside, obviously, with a ranking of 10th percentile. Longer term, 2 years, 90 bips above policy index, 3 years up 110, and 5 years up 110 with very high rankings. For the fiscal year, I'm going to concentrate on that. For the one quarter, though, U.S. equity composite up 3% versus 2.7 for the 80-20 custom benchmark, large, small. And 1 year up 24.1 versus 21.8, or 230 bips of outperformance. And all managers contributed on a gross basis, at least. Delaware was up 30 bips for the quarter. Dodge & Cox was had a very strong quarter, as they just reported, and the two small cap emerging managers were above benchmark by sizable amounts. On the international equity on page 7, both managers performed well for the fiscal year, LSV up 280 and Pyramus up 380. International equity composite up 17.4 versus 14.1 for 330 bips of outperformance. And both managers outperformed for the most recent quarter ending June 30th. And fixed income, same thing on the fiscal one-year basis, with Dodge and Cox leading the way up 2.6 versus minus 0.7 for the aggregate, and PIMCO flat for the year. Real estate REITs, we're in the BlackRock passive index for the last couple quarters, and direct lending just called Capital at the end of the quarter, as I stated. Page 8, longer-term 10-year fund up 7.5% versus 7% policy. And page 9, for the quarter, the good news is that all of the major asset classes added value, U.S. equity, international equity, and U.S. fixed. Page 16, the U.S. equity market returns. As you can see, the one-year number to June 30th was very, very strong, with the Russell 3000 up 21.5 with the purplish color. The last quarter was a bit of a challenge. However, overall, the Russell 3000 was up 2.7, which included that one-month period sell-off after May 22nd. I'm going to go to page 16. And the Russell 1000 Growth Index, you can see the best performer was Tesla Motors, up 183% in the one-quarter period. Many are describing Tesla as a disruptive technology to the carbon-based cars, and it's gone up crazy in value of the stock, but there's many who think that's the type of car of the future, and Detroit is way behind what Tesla has produced, and it might be in Detroit's interest to maybe even take out Tesla at a higher price than it is now, because it's such a disruptive technology. We shall see.
Are there any Tesla dealerships in Texas? My guess would be there's not very many.
Don't know. Wasn't there a movie made not too long ago about who killed the electric car?
Yeah, I saw that.
I don't know.
It was Republicans. I'm sorry.
Well, Jim doesn't have one in his collection.
That's true.
Page 19 is Capital Prospects. They, as I said, struggled for the quarter with the total portfolio down 1.1%, stock selection down 60 bips. Page 20 gives their quarterly performance for the last 12 quarters or 3 years, and you can see the down quarter on the far right followed after three good quarters. Delaware has a portfolio of 30 stocks on page 21 concentrated. They were a second manager that struggled in the quarter, page 22 down 1.7%, with stock selection accounting for minus 2.7 offset by other factors. And page 23 at the bottom is their 12 quarters of performance, with the most recent a down period, but 9 of the 12 quarters being up, accounting for their strong 3-year return. Page 25 is Dodge & Cox Equity. Up 1.8% for the quarter. Selection was good at plus 1.2. And page 26, their quarterly performance, you can now see 4 of the last 6 quarters up, with the 2 quarters down, only down slightly, exhibiting their turnaround in performance. Page 28 is Legato. Strong quarter, up 1.2%, attributed all to stock selection. And in the bottom of page 29, their quarterly performance, 5 of the last 6 quarters up, 7 of the last 9 up. So they've turned around their performance also on a 3-year basis. We go to page 33, which is LSV, our non-U.S. Value manager, up 1.2%. over the Aquiex U.S. index benchmark for the quarter. And then on page 36 is Pyramus, which was up who had a very strong quarter as our non-U.S. Growth manager, 3.8%, of which 3.3% came from selection. Pages 37 detail the fixed income managers, which has a group with about 4/5 of the assets Dodge & Cox and 1/5 PIMCO, and Dodge & Cox had a very strong year due primarily to their low duration and their overweight to corporates throughout the year. Page 38 is the bottom right, that same chart I think they presented, except not going 6 years back, but just the end of June of 2012, a year ago. The bottom line in purple and the most recent line in yellow, the most recent quarter. And you can see the spike up in yields from a year ago in the previous quarter across the whole yield curve after the front end remains down close to zero. It was clearly a steepening. The Fed talk of tapering essentially was a tightening of rates, where yields and real yields rose about 100 basis points. That had an effect of a valuation adjustment on all assets as fixed income and equity future cash flows were discounted back at a higher rate than had been prior to that talk of tapering. And we've seen a correction in both markets with yields spiking up in fixed income, and equities now down about 5% from their highs in the U.S. With that, I will stop and take any questions on the quarterly, but it was a very good fiscal year. It will help our funding ratio, I would think, a lot as we drop off a bad year and add a very good year. But that is now behind us, and we'll move on to the month of July, the first month of fiscal year 2014.
Okay, Paul.
Can you go back to page 3 for a minute?
What page, John?
3.
3, yes.
Item 4.
Mm-hmm.
You said Raven has depreciated 7% in June. What does that mean?
That is a direct lender who called very little capital and reflects an adjustment of us coming in not at the first close and some fees. It's
a small loss based on a very small amount of capital called.
So what are we talking about in terms of dollars?
I think it was $69,000. I have it.
It was dinky. I can't remember, but it was small.
7% loss was 69.
They haven't called that much capital yet.
Pardon me?
They haven't called that much capital yet.
Right.
Okay.
Stay with me. It was...
They're not getting out of the chute in very good shape.
Actually, as of July... I have as July 31st, and it was their net loss is $5,735.
On an investment of what?
Total contributions of $10.6 million at the end of July, distributions of $650,000, and a net loss of $5,735. So as of the end of July... That loss has been basically erased.
What's the distribution amount?
$650,000.
So is that where this depreciation comes into play?
I don't know. I don't have June. I'm just looking at July's statement. This was as of June, so I think there must
because
have been.
Because they called some capital, and they immediately returned some capital shortly thereafter.
Yeah.
It's almost a little strange. You know, I think that they had called the capital. They had an investment in mind, and then they changed their mind or something, and turned around and gave it right back.
I'm writing this thing for the first time like everybody else, but I've been told that in direct lending there's a J curve to expect, which is like that. In almost every case, the first period of time you buy in, it actually depreciates, and then your earnings start kicking in and go to the end of your...
Okay, so this should not be an alarming.
No.
Okay.
I think it's expected. Really,
and I think, I'll have to look at our performance group, but I'm looking at, like I said, the July, end of July statement, which is 1 month after the quarter end, obviously. But based on this, they're basically flat.
Okay.
Yeah, he raised $152 million. Okay. He raised $152 million, but he's only found about $30 to $40 million to invest in. So the rest of it's sitting there, and he's feeling pressure to find something to put it, yeah.
Okay.
But he wants to do the diligence too. So
it almost looks like that 7% loss includes the distribution, which shouldn't be counted as part of
that's
that.
That's what I think it
so
is.
So we remember that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It would decrease the amount of
the capital call. Yeah, exactly.
Take
it should
into account.
Yeah. Right.
I'm pretty sure that's what it is.
That's what it looks like. Yeah.
Hey, Paul, on page 37.
Yes, Mike.
On the fixed income.
Yes.
On the peer rankings, I had every split that we have, Dodge and Cox is significantly lower in peer rankings, meaning better than PIMCO.
They're different managers, Dodge and Cox.
So, well, my question is, why don't we, just go with Dodge and Cox and not do PIMCO if they're always coming in behind?
It's two reasons. One is to pair Dodge and Cox up with a manager who has a different style of them, where they would produce both positive monthly excess returns in the long run, but their correlation to one of them would be low. And two would be for those times where the credit markets sell off and spreads widen in corporates, PIMCO ought to protect us in those time periods. This has been an elongated period since the lows in the markets in March 2009, where credit has done very well as spreads have narrowed. And Dodge and Cox, as you can see from their most recent quarterly, was 45% in corporates versus 21, I think, for the benchmark. So they're going to benefit from that. PIMCO is more heavier in treasuries and lower in credit, so they give you some diversification and will protect us in periods when spreads happen to widen.
So you're saying by having both of them, it broadens our risk profile?
It lowers our risk of the total.
Yeah,
yes.
It spreads it across a wider variety of...
And we still kept 1/5 of the assets with Dodge and Cox and only 1/5 with PIMCO.
There's another interesting discussion coming regarding those two when we get to your value managers thing, too.
Right.
I thought it was kind of interesting, though, about how heavily Dodge and Cox was into the lower credit ratings. And when that market does move, we will see a lot of volatility there.
Yes, so far it's, in the long run, they ought to generate a higher return than the benchmark in PIMCO because they're overweight
quote, more risky assets within their universe, being corporates and lower investment grade and even below investment grade corporates. But with that does come some volatility, which PIMCO dampens out a little bit by having a fifth of the assets.
Because if the rates start to rise, the spreads are going to widen on those lower credit ratings.
Potentially, although corporates tend to do well in raising rate environments if rates are rising because of economic growth.
Well, that probably won't be the reason.
Right.
And because those lower qualities, by looking at that list, is very heavily rated weighted towards the financial sectors.
Yes.
I think
we were having that discussion before the session today on Dodge and Cox. We recognize they take We recognize they take a higher risk than their benchmark, and over time they ought to outperform by being a riskier asset class, but do we need to consider a more customized benchmark that truly reflects their overweight, their systematic overweight in corporates? Yes.
And we think there's maybe skewed a little bit. I have a feeling that's what you're going to point out here, the big difference in the value added between PIMCO and Dodge & Cox. Yeah, we think that the benchmark may not be that appropriate for Dodge & Cox.
Well, not only the big difference in value added, but what we're actually paying them to do it.
Right.
We're paying
next to nothing.
Yeah, we're paying Dodge & Cox about a fourth of what we're paying PIMCO.
Well, that's because of our 45-year relationship.
Well.
Yeah, but
we're getting more than four times the production too, so it's like a 16 times deal.
I think that's why we keep that ratio at 4-1. Yes,
but it comes back to Mike's discussion though. Why not put more of it there?
Well, I think diversification is the big reason. Yeah, right? It's like putting your eggs in one basket.
Well, plus we're looking at them after a prolonged period of good corporate credit performance, so it's a point of time where they're going to look very good.
They're in the lower tier here. All the ratings, there's obviously other.
Yeah, but they've added value since inception. They're a good complement to Dodge & Cox, and they bring a totally different style than Dodge & Cox.
One of the things that we're working on right now that we've been working on for a few months is that I'd like to start looking at performance more in terms of risk than just return. And I think what I want to see is what is the contribution of a manager to the overall risk? How much risk do they bring to the overall portfolio? And does their inclusion into the portfolio produce a commensurate amount of risk reduction in the overall portfolio? I'd really like us, and then I'm going through the motions to develop these types of informational exhibits, you really start to look at risk more than just return. I think we spend a lot of time on return and value added, and we don't necessarily look at risk budgeting and how much these managers are helping us to reduce the overall risk of the portfolio. And I think the investment world, financial world, is kind of trending that way. We're starting to get away from just total returns.
Yes.
And start looking at performance more in terms of risk, and I'd like to push us in that direction as well.
I think it's good to calculate and know where you are. It can be at times uncomfortable building a portfolio based solely on risk. And clearly the last 4 years is an example of that, where equities have roared and many plans have taken equity risk out of their portfolio to the extent where they're lagging significantly where they used to be.
I think a good way of looking at it is if a manager is beating the benchmark by 1% or 100 basis points, but they're taking on twice the risk of the benchmark, and that may not necessarily
yes.
be a good thing.
And
so
I
we
think
have to look at return and risk relative to one another.
And I think a third component of that is the avenue we started based on Jeff is performance-based fees
yep.
for some of our managers, particularly managers, obviously Dodge and Cox at 10 basis points. We're not going to touch that. But we started with LSV and Pyramus, and we've gotten a response back from LSV. We're waiting for Pyramus. Frankly, the response back from LSV is not satisfactory because they refused initially to include a clawback in their performance schedule, which I would insist on. But at least we're starting that process where we can align them more with us.
I understand why we want to have two managers and offsetting strategies, but there are other managers out there. correct, in fixed income.
Yes.
And maybe there's a, we should look at a third or a fourth option if one is consistently trailing his peer ranking, in the peer ranking. That's my only point.
But it costs.
Okay, Paul, monthly performance?
Monthly for July. I'd help if I had July instead of June. July was a good start to fiscal year 2014. Russell 3000 was up 5.5%. And small caps were very, very strong. You can see the 2000 growth up 7.56%, which has brought the year-to-date one-year numbers in, you know, extreme, highly performance numbers. Russell 3000 up 26.9% for the 1 year. Non-U.S. developed was also up, up 4.4% was the ACWI-X U.S., the EFI up 5.3%, and emerging markets continue to lag up 1.1%. Emerging markets have been challenged due to a couple factors. One is the slowdown in China, which may or may not be true. I guess the if it is true, how much of the slowdown, and the talk of tapering has had the effect of taking capital flows out of emerging market countries being repatriated back to the U.S. You see the one-year number for emerging markets down 8.4 versus up 20.3 for the Russell 3000. Fixed income was up slightly for the month. The aggregate up 14 basis points, and high yield continued to had a good month also, up 1.9%. You see the red numbers for 3 years and year-to-date and 1 year for most of the indices with the exception of cash and high yield. Page one. Summary investments, the market value increased to $1,592,000, $592 million. And the ranges are within their bands. Domestic equities have bumped up towards the top with their relative outperformance to fixed income and non-U.S. equities. Page two. The fund increased by $45 million from the prior month, so it's a very strong month, and up $193 million from the prior year. You can see direct lending did go down, and that was from some distributions, actually, early on, as was alluded to earlier. Page three, allocations by manager. White Oak had not had their capital call till August, so they are not listed there. And page four, cash levels are about as low as they've been at the manager level on the equity side for a while. And page five, performance for July. Capital Prospects did have a good month of July, outperforming by 60 basis points. Everyone else was fairly tight. Legato was down 69. Total domestic equity up 5.71 versus 5.48 for 23 basis points of outperformance. And the fiscal year to date is the 1 month matching July.
Well, if I could interrupt you 1 second, just to let everybody know, the targets and the ranges here are not, they haven't been revised based on the asset liability workshop that we did last November. And so that's going to be taken care of. So it looks like there's some things that are a little out of whack. They're not. We just need to revise the targets and the ranges.
All right. What we've done is we've revised the policy index, adding direct lending at 2% initially based on capital calls, and that will be continue to be rise upward to the final policy index level of 7 or 7.5, if my memory fails me, as capital continues to be called up to final
7.5,
yeah. Dodge and Cox outperformed by 39 basis points for July, and you see Medley and Raven. There were some write-ups with Medley and Raven against their on the valuation of their portfolio on the limited capital that has been called. LSV had a good month, up 70 basis points, 5.1 versus 4.4. And overall, the portfolio, the total fund returned 3.32, right in line with policy of 3.29. As I said, that was a good start for the first month of fiscal year, although this month we've seen a sell-off. And at the rolling 3 years for the managers, look pretty good overall. Page 6, Dodge and Cox, we've seen improvement on equity. Delaware, strong returns on a 3-year rolling basis. Capital Prospect between 2 and 3%. Legato has had a nice trend upward where they're now right above 1%. LSVU also trending back up to the 1% level. Pyramus very strong on page 11 at 2%. And Dodge and Cox fixed income trending up around 1.5%. So I will take any questions on July or the markets in August.
Any questions? Seeing none, we'll move right into top 10 holdings.
Okay, top 10 holdings. This is taken as of August 15th, and at that point in time, the markets had sold off about 1% across the board. There's the non-U.S. LSV. The Acquiex U.S. was up roughly 2% as of August 15th. And I have no unusual items report for any of the managers. If need be, I can go through each one, but nothing unusual here.
Does anybody have any questions? Okay, seeing none, thank you, Paul.
Sure.
We'll move right into Executive Director 9A, the value-added report for second quarter 2013.
I'm not going to spend a lot of time on this. I will ask if you have any questions, but a couple things that I wanted to point out is that since June 30th, 2008 now, all of our active managers that we currently have at Stansera have added value. Dodge and Cox, if you look, Dodge and Cox Equity, if you look at this page right here, you'll see that cumulatively they have finally pulled themselves out. And Wendell was alluding to that earlier today, that last cumulative value they've actually added now $1 million over the last 5 years after fees. So they are in the positive. They've been one of the ones that have been the biggest underperformers since we started reporting this out, but they have pulled it out. The other thing I wanted to mention, and it's already been said today, is that the active managers over the last fiscal year have added over $28 million in value over and above the benchmark, which to me is, I've really never seen anything quite that exceptional. That translates to about 300 basis points of alpha or excess returns, which is, again, phenomenal. But I want to remind you that this is, a lot of this is probably random. There's some luck involved. We do have some good managers, but this is a very transitory type business and a very transitory type statistic that I'm reporting out to you, and I just don't think that we should expect to see this all the time.
Well, 2008 would have showed a difference.
Oh, absolutely.
Because they all would have run it over the cliff.
Yeah, so. But 300 basis points and $28 million for a portfolio of our size just seems incredible. So I think we got a little lucky.
Yeah, good. A couple of questions, yes. Rick. On just the third page in, which says total fee summary at the top, 630.08 to 630.13.
Correct.
Now, that clear over the second from the right-hand column, it says total. Down at the bottom is $23 million.
Mm-hmm.
We divide that by five is basically what we've been paying per year, right?
Yes.
So somewhere in the $4.5 million range or something like that.
4.6, I think it is.
Yeah, for $1.5 billion.
Well, in this case, it was on average, it was about $1.3 billion.
Okay. Yeah, okay. And it'll bump up as our years go good. And
yes.
But so what I did is I took this column, over to the right, you see Dodge & Cox large cap value is 20.8 basis points, so basically 21 basis points. Went two pages back to the value added summary for the same period of time, and then just layered in those actual basis points next to how much they returned on a percentage basis, so that I can see that We paid 21 basis points for Dodge & Cox large cap value to give us 0.6% return. So it's just helping me to establish what we paid versus what we got. Mm-hmm. Some of them aren't very good, but like Delaware large cap, we paid 51 basis points for 5.9% return, which is a lot better deal than what we paid for the guys above us. For the capital prospects, the gals in Connecticut, we paid 82 basis points, which is a lot, but we got 7.5% return. So when you look at that way, you're thinking that's a better value than if you look down there at Mike's PIMCO, where we paid 38 basis points for 1.6% return.
Right.
I just thought it would be helpful, I think, to combine the two so we can kind of keep track of that as we're going along.
One thing we have to keep in mind, I think that Delaware and Capital Prospects are exceptional managers. And the other thing that we have to keep in mind is that, again, we are getting value by having other managers. We don't want to get to a situation where we're just picking one or two best managers we have and throw all our money at them. We want to continue to diversify it. Mm-hmm. And I don't think we're ever going to be able to find 7 or 8 managers that are performing as well as Cap Prospects or Delaware. So we're going to have some laggards here amongst our entire active portfolio.
But I think it gives credence to Mike's question of if PIMCO, because that's on the table right now, if PIMCO is consistently consecutive, whatever that is, on the lower part of their peer group, and they're not performing very well, then at some point in time we might say, why don't we start looking at the upper part of the peer group and maybe start some shift? I mean, another one that I would look at right away, because none of us have been very impressed for a while, is Legato.
Yeah, Legato.
We paid 108 basis points for a 1.6% return.
They had a good year last year, but they've pretty much been just barely keeping their heads above water the whole time. Absolutely.
They've been improving, though.
They have. Lately, they've been improving.
Yes, but it bears watching.
And just to reiterate it, I mean, the big winner was Dodge & Cox Fixed, which I'd never seen that before. Only 11 basis points for almost a 7.5% return.
I think we're going to be looking at Dodge & Cox Fixed a little differently after we change.
And we do have $450 million with them.
Yeah.
So that's a big bump.
Good deal.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So good work.
Thank you.
Okay, if there's no further questions on that, item 9B, new legislation update. Dawn.
We got a really good an email from Mr. Palmer, the executive director of SACRS, and he gave us an update of what the legislative committee there has been working on. They took on this huge task of going through the entire 37 Act and trying to make sure that every code section had wording in it that would make the PEPRA rules apply. And so they were able to do a lot of that just by adding, most code sections say under this chapter, well, PEPRA doesn't fall under this chapter, so they just added some additional language to most of them. There were a few areas that they are recommending some changes, and they're working with the legislature to try to get those incorporated. And one of those sections applied specifically to Stanislaus County. As you know, our Tier 3 plan is currently closed, but with the possibility that someday it could be reopened, we wanted to make sure that it would comply, so we had asked to have some wording changes there. That led to some additional information that they have given us. So we know that if Tier 3 were to ever be reopened, we would need to get some additional legislative changes to correct that code section. And they gave us some additional information on how the actuaries have requested some changes on how the rates are calculated, with PEPRA stating that the rates have to be exactly 50-50 split. That isn't work. It doesn't work well actuarially with the 37X systems, with the rounding issues that are currently in the legislation. So they are asking for some changes there to improve that section for 37X. and then, of course, the 401A limits that have been in place for the IRS limiting the amount of compensation that can be used for a final average salary. They've added some wording to that so that the for anyone that falls under the PEPR plans, that 401A does apply to them, but the additional limits set by PEPRA also apply. And then we also have that they are recommending to have all systems use the CPI all urban consumers when they're making the adjustment to the final average salary cap under PEPRA, rather than having each system use a the regional indices to try to keep that uniform. So these are just some areas that they're looking, the Sackers Legislative Committee have made some recommended language changes to them, and the legislatures are considering these changes, and so we'll be watching these to see what eventually happens when all of this goes through.
So that last issue that Don just talked about, I had originally told you that we would be bringing an item that would ask you what version of the All Consumer Price Index we would be using, but this pretty much takes that out of the picture, and everybody's going to be using the same one, and they're going to be calculating the change over the year-over-year change as of September, on a September to September basis. So we will no longer have to put that question to you.
So which one are you going to use?
We use the All Urban Consumer Price Index, which is the one that the entire country essentially uses.
And does that one include the food and fuel?
That is the headline. That's the headline, right? I think the All Consumer Price. So that, no, that does not include.
I don't think any of
no.
That. That's why there was this movement to do the change, CPI,
right.
So that you would consider.
This one's much less volatile. That one would be an extremely volatile price index to use. I think that they're wise not to use the one that has food and energy. Because I think over the long run, you're going to trend towards the long-run natural rate of inflation. But when you, it's like almost like actuarial smoothing. When you use market versus actuarial assets, you're always going to trend over time to your actual market value of assets, but you get rid of those market fluctuations. And that's the difference between using headline inflation and something that takes out energy and food prices. It's a much more stable number. You'd probably see your retirement benefit bouncing around quite. You'd probably see your COLA bouncing around quite a bit if they used the one that included energy and fuel or food.
But there's a proposal to use chain for Social Security.
Yeah, I've seen that.
Okay, item 9C, discussion action for approval of trustee attendance at the Opal Summit in Santa Barbara. I know this is something that Michael O'Neill brought forward. So, Kelly?
I provided the document with the agenda and a little brief synopsis of what it's offering. But if you would like a comparison to what's being offered that you normally go to in January in Arizona, I have a few facts about that if you want to hear those or if you have enough information in front of you.
It doesn't matter to me. I mean, I just saw this one and thought that it looked kind of interesting. I went to the one in Arizona last year, and I could go to either one of them.
The major differences are it has investor classes. There is public funds that are in attendance for the one in Santa Barbara, but the one in Arizona is directed for education to public pensions. It's the one in Santa Barbara is smaller. It's about 250 people that will be going. It's more education, investment education classes.
I support education, so I'll make a motion to approve.
That would be up to the board if you want.
So we have a motion to approve attendance. Do I hear a second?
I'll second. I'm not interested in voting, but I'll second.
Okay. So we have a motion and a second. Any further discussion? Seeing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? So aye. Move.
Nice.
Huh?
You got
oh, you went to that.
Opposed?
Two no's over there.
No, I didn't.
Oh, just one.
Are you getting cross-eyed?
No, I heard you too. I'm sorry.
Okay. She must have said it twice.
Yeah.
So you're exactly the same color.
Okay.
Well, no, actually you're black and white.
Okay, General Counsel has no closed session items, so we will move straight into members' forum. Gordon?
Pass.
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 Okay. Joan? Pass. Pass.
Pass.
Pass. Pass. Donna?
Pass.
Pass. Maria?
Pass.
Pass. Mike?
Pass.
Pass.
Pass. Pass.
Staff? Anybody? Going once? Going twice? All in, all out? All right. This meeting is adjourned.